I've taken bits and pieces from all of my other career moments to forge the position that I have now. And it kind of makes me wonder whether or not UX design is like an entry level job, even. Like, I kind of wonder, like, if you need to have other stuff in order to do this job, because you need to know how to design, visual design. You need to know how to test, research and being able to have a conversation. You need to know how to write. You need to know how to do like so many things across the entire spectrum of the design thinking process that it's kind of something you can't ask someone with a 4-year degree who's just coming out of school and expect them to be able to do all these things.
Hello, everyone. In this episode, I'm talking to Anthony Conta, who is an award-winning product designer at Amazon, author, educator, inventor, and mentor, lots of things. Anthony talks about his career journey and experience in creating board games, which is one of his passions. We also discuss UX bootcamps, AI's role in UX, job search strategies, and portfolio on resume tips. To wrap it up, Anthony shares his experience writing his first book, The Art and Science of UX Design. By the way, he shared a promo code that will give you 35% discount of the list price, Conta, Conta. Hope you enjoyed this episode. Welcome, Anthony. Welcome. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. I can't complain that it's Friday and looking forward to the weekend.
Absolutely. Same here.
Thanks for coming and thanks for being willing to really share your story, because your story is very, very interesting and very rich in different steps and different careers even, what it feels like. So I'll ask a few questions on that and really share some career advice, because I see that you're also very active in helping, giving back to the UX community and helping folks who are earlier in their career with getting job and becoming better designers.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mentor a lot, I write a lot. I've gone through this process, so I feel like I have a lot of empathy for it. So I'm happy to chat about any of it.
So probably you'll repeat the same message for the 100th time.
Maybe.
About
but,
what should be in the portfolio. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, we'll see. Okay, let's start with your story. So your story is very rich with, as I mentioned, like different companies, different roles, different products that you worked on. You have a what looks like a passion in education and games and different more like interactive experiences, which is probably, I wouldn't say my strength, but yeah, probably not a weakness, but not my strength. So I would love to learn more about like, why did you start this, like the design and working in design? What really drives you and what do you do today?
Yeah, absolutely. So maybe we can start with today. So currently I'm working at Amazon, senior UX designer, product designer, whatever you want to call it, working on Amazon Music. My remit is essentially, how do we make things more immersive with our product? You know, like, you come to Amazon Music, how do we make that an experience that you want to like keep leaning into and enjoy, and as you play back your podcast or your music or what have you. So to get there, it was a pretty long journey from a lot of different types of places and industries. It started in economics. So I got a master's in economics, financial economics, and I went to a law firm and I would help figure out how to sue people from like an antitrust perspective, just like wasn't what I wanted to do. Tried it at a consulting firm. Didn't really like it there either. So my first like foray into design professionally was I actually made my own game company. So I ended up making board games with my then girlfriend, now wife. And we would come up with these ideas and we'd publish them on Kickstarter. We'd get funding for them, go to conventions, and eventually get them all the way to the hands of publishers who would then publish them for us. To support that, I would do some teaching and tutoring on the side, including teaching 3-year-olds how to play chess. That was one of more of the odd jobs that I had, but that actually like helped me be a better designer. We could go into that as well. Yeah, and then I went to make like interactive media at Nickelodeon, where like the call and response shows of the 90s, where you'd like shout at the TV. Instead of it like being at the TV, it was on your phone. So I learned how to like make interactive designs on the phone by thinking of those experiences. That all led me to my boot camp. So I went to General Assembly to learn like the skills and techniques of like UX proper through them. And from that, I went to Kaplan, I went to Food Network, I went to Vimeo, and I finally landed at Amazon. So lots of stuff in there. Happy to chat about any of it, really.
Yeah. Well, let me ask a few clarifying questions on different I guess, chapters of your career. So first of all, why did you abandon your passion for board game design and sales? Because it sounds like that you had like almost like your own side gig, right?
Yeah.
And that was almost like an income source. So why did you decide to go and work as an employee?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for board games specifically, it's pretty hard to maintain strong margins, especially living in New York City. For like that type of business, a lot of board game companies don't really like operate out of New York City, for example. There might be like one or two. So it's like really hard to maintain the expenses of that. And I just didn't want that for my life. Like I didn't want to like be maintaining a company and like being like a CEO. Like I wanted to do the design. Like that's what always drives me. Like I like doing and making cool things. So that's kind of what like made me want to like make those games, but I didn't want to like run a company in order to make those games. So I pivoted to more of like a user experience type of career where I get to like make those designs and interactions and experiences without having to worry about like, you know, finances, for example, or like headcount or like payroll or any of this other stuff.
So even though your foundational education was in business and economics, right? So it's like you didn't enjoy that activity, these kind of activities at all?
No, I did not. I got this, like, I went to school, got this master's, hoped I would get like a job on the other side of that. And it just like wasn't what I wanted. I actually went to school for like computer science because I wanted to like code games. Hmm. But my introduction to coding was pretty rocky and I didn't really, like, I don't like to code.
Didn't stick with it, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, the tools have gotten easier now, as have like the learning and processes.
Maybe that's true.
That's true. Yeah, at the time.
I'll have a question for you about the coding of games a bit later when we talk about AI, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Sure.
But going back to your story and one of your roles, right? So you mentioned that you were also working at Nickelodeon for like to design this kind of interactive learning experience for kids. How would you describe designing for children? Because from what I don't think I have ever designed anything for this audience. But from what I've read online, it may be quite challenging and it requires a bit different approach to designing and to also doing research. So maybe you can elaborate on that part of your story.
Yeah, absolutely. So like designing for kids is really interesting because you just have to like be very straightforward and obvious with some of your elements. And like testing with them is really hard. So, for example, we couldn't test anything in grayscale. It had to be 100% full fidelity finished product, essentially, in order to do testing. Like prototypes didn't really
work
as well. So when your entire pipeline structured around that, like you have to be really certain about what you're making and get as much clear signals as you can. So we dedicated research experts who had masters in like learning science specifically for children to understand that. Legally, I was not allowed to be in the same room as the child, which is like, how am I supposed to test that with them? So ended up, again, those researchers doing that for us. But, you know, like you might be in the middle of a prototype testing session and you want to like guide that, or you learn something and you want to double click into that. It's harder to do so when you're not able to moderate it yourself. Also, if you made something and children didn't want to interact with it, they just wouldn't. So like you'd go into a user test and like try to like play this game with a kid and they'd just be like, nope, not interested. And like that, just you wouldn't be able to get data from it. I'll tell you one anecdote about it that like really shaped my thinking about it. So we were around the office, we were making interaction and it was, a pair of drums on like a screen and it was like on a phone. So we had this like little pair of drums and we'd show it to all the adults, who were building the product, and they'd like use their fingers very lightly and they'd like tap around like, oh, it like makes drum sounds. Cool. we brought that interaction into user testing on an iPad and put it in front of a kid. And then the kid all of a sudden took their two hands and started smacking the iPad, beating it really hard. Because all they saw were drums, right? They didn't see a $600 device in front of them. So it was a really interesting learning moment for us of like, well, maybe we just want to make more delicate interactions with our interactive media than just a pair of like bongos.
Yeah, that's a very interesting insight. And I think this is one of those almost like aha moments when you really can realize that your point of view and your opinion and your how you even think about things, like what you like take as a given, like really kind of how you would interact with the tablet, right? could be completely wrong for a different target audience. That's a very, it's a funny one. Yeah.
And that was really hammered home to me to like just see that, you know, pun not intended.
Yeah, that's cool. Okay, so going back to your gaming and board games, right? The fun employed. So sounds like a very interesting story with, I even saw like a video on College Humor. So it was like a product placement, or they were so in love with the game that they just had an episode for that?
Yeah, it was a sponsored ad, I think. But yeah, that was a pretty wild game. So for context, that's actually one of the first games I made that with my wife. It is a game about applying to jobs. So you have to, you know, figure out how to apply to a job. And there's like all these jobs are like real jobs or like jobs you'd expect to see, but the qualifications are completely things you wouldn't say in an interview. So you have to like tell the narrative. It's like an improv game. You get these four cards and you have to tell the narrative of why you'd be a good like astronaut. And you like have to string that together, by telling a story about it. The development of that game was really fun. I came home one night, and I was talking to my wife and a friend, and we were just like, hey, I have an idea for a game. Just tell me about all these jobs and all the crazy things that you could do on these jobs. And we came up with the list of cards. And over time, we would test this with friends, test it at parties, do user testing of it, do the design of it, so on and so forth, all the way through to getting it to Kickstarter. And it got published like three or four times. There's like three different publishers. First, like an indie, second, another indie, and then third actually got published by Mattel. So it was published for a very long time. A fun fact about that game, I actually used it to propose to my wife. We were at a birthday party and I applied to be her husband and I got the job. So it was great.
Oh, that's cool. Do you still have the job?
I do. Yeah. Thankfully.
That's good. That's good. So the game works.
It does. It's a proved game. Gets you the job.
That's a very interesting story. Maybe just kind of because I haven't done anything in Kickstarter. What did you mean by saying that several publishers published it? How did it work?
So we did a print run with the first publisher. In order to facilitate that print run, we needed to get money for it. So we did a Kickstarter so that we could get that. After interacting with that publisher for a little bit, I decided to cancel that contract and try to find a new publisher. So I did. And with that new publisher, we did a second print run of the game, updating the aesthetic, adding new cards, adding expansions. And then we mutually decided to try to find a bigger publisher for like a third print run. So we found Mattel and worked out a deal to publish it with them.
Have you explored it's almost like a book publishing, right? So the same kind of concept. Yeah. So it's like a company who just takes care of all the logistics and production, right?
Right.
Have you thought of going like the self-publishing route? Like I would guess it's possible.
It is. Yeah. And plenty of companies do that. That kind of goes back to my earlier point of like, that's just not what excites me about my work. Yeah. You know, like I could have done it myself, but like, I don't really care about trying to figure out freight shipping for games coming from one country going into another, which is what my business partners did. Right. Like they thought about that. I don't care to have the phone calls with like store managers of like stocking my game. You know, I care about making the game, like sharing it with people.
Yeah, that's interesting. A possible solution that I see could, and like the reason why I asked about the self-publishing is because going back to your point about the sustaining your life, like from just financial point of view. So this, like as I understand, like from your experience, wasn't really a very appealing path to go for, to continue, right? So a self-publisher, because I know, like, at least I've heard that publishing companies, either in books or courses or whatever you choose, they take quite a big cut. And like sometimes, actually, I was frankly shocked by how much they would be taking. Maybe I just don't realize the value they bring. But I thought maybe actually by going the self-publishing route would be a more financially savvy option to maybe continue doing this. But yeah, going back to this kind of the responsibilities of running a company and like taking care of all the chores like this that you're not enjoying this yet, it's kind of definitely a harder sell to go with that.
Yeah, and it's about reach too, right? Like I could never get into the store shelves
network,
of, like I got into store shelves of like Iceland, Ireland on these trips that I never would have experienced. Like my wife and I saw the game in the places that we went and visited internationally. And I don't think I would have been able to do it there, or maybe I would have, but like just the amount of energy and effort put into that would just be really high relative to the feasibility of like what else I could do with my time.
So. Yeah. You could have hired probably like a CEO or like some kind of like the ops manager.
Yeah. And those were the partnerships that I was doing. So like one of the partnerships we, you know, and I'm not going to go into details exactly, but like it was much more favorable from a financial perspective to
structure. Outsource, kind of delegate the things that you didn't enjoy. Right.
So it's like a partnership. Like if, I mean, if I partnered with a CEO, sure.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Got it. Awesome. Okay. So, but yeah, it's just kind of probably a magical feeling when you see your creation in a country or like by people from different countries that they use and love, right? Because it seems to me that the whole like board games community, like as a whole, these are quite passionate folks, and they if they love your game, they kind of would really be like advertisers for you. Yeah. For free, and they would love it doing this as well.
100%.
Magical feeling, I assume. Okay, so looking at your mentoring activities, it feels like maybe it connects to kind of this passion of yours, like of education and really sharing what you know with others. How it just like it's your list is quite long. So how do you really manage to combine your day job, your life, and all this passion and side projects of yours?
Yeah, no, great question.
And one more question. And what really drives you? Like, because it definitely by doing these activities, you have to sacrifice your time, right? Because you could have spent it like, I don't know, chilling or going for a walk. Yeah. So it's really, it means that it's important to you. So I'm curious to hear like what also drives you.
Yeah. So to answer your first point, how do I find the time? I think the pandemic really helped. You know, like I saved like 12 hours a week on my commute alone, 10 to 12, something like that. So that just already gave me back some of that time. I think it's about defining where I want to go in my career. So I'm like very interested in continuing to push as like an individual contributor and giving back where I can. So I think I make the time for it as well. And that gets to a little bit about like what drives me. So I went through this transition. Like I went to General Assembly. I did the boot camp, the fully immersive thing. And I tried getting the job on the other side. And like, it's really hard. It is really hard to make that transition. And it's also just like, you know, what do you do next once you do make that transition? So as a mentor, I try to like help guide students into making the transition. And then like early stage, like, what do you do once you're out of like maybe your first job or something like that? So I, you know, making the time isn't the hardest, like maybe it's like a night or two sometimes as well, depending upon the engagement. It's just fun teaching these classes too. So like I teach a couple classes, and just, it's really rewarding to like help someone achieve their goals, I think as well. So that just kind of brings me back to mentoring. Cause it's just like, here's a person, they really want this thing. They want to make their lives better and like pursue this path for whatever reason. And you're able to be a part of that journey, which is like really sweet.
Yeah, I can relate. Definitely a unique feeling when a person who is in need of help and you help them and they basically go through this roadblock or kind of get to this next step. Definitely a unique feeling. I agree. It's and it's very, feels good and fulfilling.
You make a really big impact, you know, in someone's life, like as a experience designer yourself, like that's what we do. We try to make people's lives better and easier, and getting like the immediate deep impact of that by like individually helping someone and catering their experience, especially through my work with like Design Lab, for example, that feels like pretty impactful.
Yeah. Talking about bootcamp, and because you went through this experience, so you're like a career switcher that used the UX bootcamp program to basically get into UX, right? And it was challenging. And I think now it's even more challenging. Yep. So there are many, I guess, controversial or sometimes opposite opinions about bootcamps in general, about UX bootcamps. Because on one hand, their business model almost like motivates them to sell the idea that it will be easy for students to get a job and like in a very appealing and growing industry. And for some folks, maybe they get lucky or they have like already previous networking skills or like kind of networks that they can utilize to get a job quicker. Mm-hmm. But it feels to me, based on the hundreds of conversations I've had with younger folks in the industry, that it's not as simple. And there is like almost like not a backlash, but some kind of questioning of the image that these boot camps, and I'm not talking in particular about the General Assembly, but like as an industry, sell this idea, kind of almost like a predatory kind of style of selling, without really any, accountability, yes.
Sure.
Without any accountability of really helping folks get a job. And as the person who went through the bootcamp, because I didn't, I'm curious to hear, like, what was your, and I see, like, you're also a mentor or kind of you participate in the General Assembly program. So I would assume that you believe in the value that they brought. But overall, kind of as an industry, what are your thoughts on, and the, like, pros and cons, and the value that the bootcamps, UX bootcamps, bring to folks who want to switch careers?
Totally. Yeah. So I think there's like a lot of truth in both perspectives. Like some camps are like, hey, boot camps are terrible, they're bad for industry. Other camps, like, boot camps are amazing, they are, do a lot for the industry, and for the people trying to transition. I think like the truth's somewhere in the middle. I think your experience really depends on the educational support around you. So for example, for my General Assembly experience, like, you know, my teachers were really important in how I would learn from that. Like one of my teachers in particular was a very strong educator who like taught me a lot that helped me accelerate my career significantly, as did the career coaching like services from that. So do I believe in all boot camps? Do I believe in all boot camps, even like from the same institution? Probably not. Like it really depends on those educators. And just like if you were to buy anything in this economy or in this system that we live in, like doing the research really matters. Know your instructors, know the reputation of that school, know the statistics that they purport. Before I went to General Assembly, I looked at their accounting statements to see just how they derived their 95% placement statistics so that I knew what I was getting into. That's really important if you're going to choose any bootcamp or program. For me, I'm most active with Design Lab, which is another one of those bootcamps, but the structure is you work one-on-one with a mentor to accomplish your projects. Like as a mentor, it's really rewarding for me to help these students, and I can see it from the students as well that they really appreciate this. But just like if you were to go to a school or a university, they don't promise you a job after 4 years. Like you shouldn't have that expectation from a bootcamp. It's up to you to get that job and make those connections. So when I went into my bootcamp, you know, I heard the high placement rates and like how easy it would be to make a transition, but I didn't particularly like believe that because I went to school and it wasn't easy to get a job after having a master's degree. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I guess I have like a little bit of skepticism there. But I still think they're helpful for people who want to learn in that way. I chose to go to a boot camp because, and I could have gotten a degree from like an institution, right? That would have taken longer. It would have cost more money. I didn't want to spend that time or money. I wanted to get it accelerated for me and hope that I would be able to find a job. And it worked out really well for me. I would go to GA again at the time that I did if the exact same things were the same. Mm-hmm. I don't regret that.
That's a good testimonial. Let's maybe go with one more question on the story, and then we'll switch to the next topic. So thinking from the, because this is also a very common question that I hear, and surprisingly, as of I understand the problem right now, but it's surprising that lots of people who switch careers, their natural instinct, especially if they're switching from non-tech industry profession, they almost dismiss all the learnings that they have had in the previous life, right? Work life. When in reality, I worked with lots of career switchers, and I actually think that having a different career prior to design brings probably more value than just going with like just one industry, because it's, first of all, completely different set of opinions and thoughts and ideas. And also those folks usually learn at least social skills like in those settings, right? Like in the previous industry, like previous profession. Mm-hmm. So I wonder for you, the question I have is, maybe you can share what you think, what value the previous, like the life before you got into UX, what skills have you learned and you are using today in your design career?
Absolutely. And first off, I think career transitioners make fantastic UX designers. Like, they have a lot of context from their previous industries. For me, I mentioned I used to be a writer and economist at a law firm. Writing's really helpful. It's a skill that goes anywhere in any job. At Amazon.
Especially Amazon, yeah.
Well, it makes a lot of sense that I'm at Amazon because of my ability to write. When I was a game designer, you know, the ability to hear feedback and try to make things fun and enjoying, you know, and delightful for the users. It makes a lot of sense that I work on an immersive product, trying to increase the fun and delight that people have in this product, because I did that as a game designer. When I was a tutor, I was teaching three-year-olds how to play chess. A lot of that required telling stories of how the pieces moved. It makes me feel like I'm a really good storyteller, which is really important. I'm sure, as you know, as a designer, trying to advocate your designs. And the list goes on and on. I've taken bits and pieces from all of my other career moments to forge the position that I have now. And it kind of makes me wonder whether or not UX design is like an entry-level job. Even like, I kind of wonder, like, if you need to have other stuff in order to do this job, because you need to know how to design, visual design. You need to know how to test, you know, research and being able to have a conversation. You need to know how to write. You need to know how to do like so many things across the entire spectrum of the design thinking process that it's kind of something you can't ask someone with a 4-year degree who's just coming out of school and expect them to be able to do all these things.
That's a very good point, especially about that a lot of skills that are required to be a successful designer and UX designer, I mean, they are not taught in schools very well, if at all. So I wonder, maybe actually a bit segue on this topic. What do you think educational institutions can do to maybe tweak or revise their programs to make sure that if somebody decides to invest 4 years of their time and go through the whole program, that they're at least not lacking almost like half of the job required skills, which is like social skills and all that stuff?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with too many programs that are 4-year bachelor's like programs for user experience design. It's usually a certificate that's a supplement. It's usually a master's program. So I'm not quite sure what you can do at the 4-year level. I imagine like English classes and, focus on more immersive projects. I think immersion was one of the benefits of like going to General Assembly, for example, and something that can really help students like learn a lot. One of the things we did with Amazon, for example, was we had a program with Pratt where students would participate in a learning experience by thinking about the future of music. As it related to Amazon Music. And they would do the entire design thinking process through that so that they could explore what that looks like. Yeah. And that immersive work really helped them contextualize what they were learning. So I think applied learning is really valuable. And that's kind of, you know, part of the pros column of like a bootcamp, for example. And if universities could have more applied learning by doing partnerships with these types of programs, I think that would help a lot.
Yeah, I agree. I think... And maybe it depends on the way how a particular person, like they're almost like learning style, like a learning preference, right? So some people learn by listening, some people learn by doing. But in general, it feels to me that it's more natural to learn by doing, right? So like really hands-on, practical. It's almost like this, I think there was a concept I've heard like about UX apprenticeship kind of program style, when you really kind of almost emerged into like the environment, ideal like real work environment, like with a real company, with a real all the technical and the business constraints and all the stuff, which is really hard to teach maybe at all, if possible at all, during like an academic kind of setup, right? So right. Yeah, I completely agree. I think it would make a huge difference, like particularly for me. Like I would like I always like to learn by being a part of something, definitely sticks better with me.
Yeah. And we had a lot of like students who felt the same way. We had over like 50% of, Pratt's eligible students like participate in this program. And it really helped them get that learning, in a structured way very quickly.
That's good. Yeah. I agree. Okay. Let's switch to the next topic. So, and this is more like a vague and open-ended question about the future of our profession and like with all the AI tools and everything. And this is almost like I repeat this question for every guest because I think I still haven't made up my mind about this. I'm kind of like, okay. Sometimes, like some days I'm really positive and like really optimistic. Other day I was like reading something else. I was like, damn, I wonder how this profession will survive after this or something like this. Because it feels like with every next day, there's like something else shows up. And like lots of companies, even though like lots of companies are kind of trying to utilize this new superpower, right, in their businesses, right. Like it's kind of really, I love seeing like more startups showing up and like more services and stuff. But mm-hmm. on the other hand, like I also see like big monster companies like Microsoft, embedding these tools into their existing products, right? Which would, sometimes it feels to me that it would actually make it even harder to compete with them because it's almost like creates this more dangerous environment for smaller companies who are trying to really, I don't know, come up with some ideas. Mm-hmm. And of course, I would argue that natural selection would do its job. But I think that there is a kind of pros and cons. But back to my point, back to the question. What are your thoughts on how our profession will change? Maybe how education also should adapt to this? Because like, especially if you're involved in all these boot camps and almost like teaching, right, activities, how would you really help new designers who are joining the field or who consider joining? What should they do now? Like, where should maybe they start learning and what exactly would be the path, the recommended path for them?
Sure. For new designers, I still think focusing on the fundamentals makes a lot of sense. They have a lot to learn. I don't think they need to know in the same way that they wouldn't need to necessarily know micro interactions or like motion design or like other flourishes that help improve an experience. Like I don't think they need to worry too much about AI in their education to start, but they should learn it at some point. I think what we're seeing now is really, and it does scare me quite a lot, probably what other generations experienced when computers were first introduced, when the internet first was introduced into the workplace. Like we're seeing the next wave of like technology influence our culture and what's possible.
The next big thing.
Right. Exactly. Like, and then like calculator metaphor is probably like really valuable here. Like, how do you have a calculator, you look at this, like it's going to replace math. It didn't replace accountants, accountants still exist, like Excel, it's going to replace
for now.
For now. Maybe ChatGPT can do your taxes, but
yeah.
I don't think this will get rid of people. I think it's another tool like everything else and people will adapt to it or be edged out of competition in the workplace. Like, it's table stakes to be able to use a computer to get a job. Today. That wasn't table stakes like 30 years ago. Just like it'll be table stakes to probably in some capacity be familiar with the potential of what AI can do down the road. So
yeah, that's true.
It's going to change stuff.
I'm probably more like on still kind of optimistic side, even though I think it will change a lot of professions and like especially the ones who deal with just kind of some data or like knowledge base, right? Which almost like you have to learn several years in school, like just kind of to memorize information. I think those would be probably impacted the most. But I also believe in the ability of humans to adapt and really kind of almost supercharge their existing skills and their knowledge and abilities to just kind of do like provide answers faster, right? Or like talking about taxes, right? I think I already saw a couple of examples of like smaller startups who tried to almost like remove the tax accountant from equation. So there was like it's almost like a calculator kind of type of tool, but for a person who is like the taxpayer in that case. So I think it will be the same idea with at least a calculator. I think it's a good metaphor to describe this tool. It's just kind of what maybe like the other side of me is still worried about that we don't know what we don't know.
Yeah.
And considering like the pace of developments and like really how things like progressing. Like it's not even by April, and we're already kind of. I think this year has been already crazy from like the amount of progress, right? Like these tools have made. So I'm just maybe like my conservative risk adverse nature kind of really thinks that there is a risk of something that would show up that we do not expect.
Yeah.
Because like it's just unknown, and it's mixed feelings.
For sure. And I think what concerns me the most is the truth of the information that it's sourcing and where this stuff comes from. So like, I don't know if you saw this week or last week, whenever it was, I think it was this week, Google Bard had, someone asked a question to Google Bard and Google Bard replied like that it was shut down, but it got that information from like another article that was like, and like a journalist had to go do that work. So the journalist is still there, like proving the truth of the matter, right? That human job function isn't gone because we need human oversight for where the sources of information are coming from. Midjourney, you're pulling from artists who, you know, haven't given consent for their work to be put into those algorithms. And there's lawsuits against that. Like we haven't figured out the policing that comes from these tools. They're powerful, but what is the implication of using them in our society, and how do we protect the people that feed and use those machines?
Yeah, that's a very good point about the data truthfulness, is if that's a word, the right word. I saw about the example that you mentioned. That's very, it was quite amusing. But on the other hand, I also kind of just asked, like gave a link to a YouTube video and asked to summarize it in a way. And then it generated saying like, here's the summarization of the video you provided to me, and then like description. And it's like several paragraphs of completely different video. I don't know where it kind of generated. Like, it's just so weird. So random, like completely different. Right. Not even like a similar topic. It's it was probably the most random output that I've seen.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a very interesting point. And I like how creatives, I already see some, I guess, but attempts from the creatives to offset the potential damage of this. Not the damage, but yeah, could be damage. By, I think somebody shared like a, I think it's just a, like a static kind of asset, but almost like created by humans, some kind of like badge,
right?
That you put on content. I immediately started thinking like that, how would you really verify this badge? Because if it's like on blockchain, but like you can still save something into blockchain that was generated by, so it's kind of, I just kind of like my mind went sideways, but it's an interesting point how, like, it's fascinating how historically humans have been just evolving and evolving, right? Like from new stimuli, like that, like AI showed up, or calculator showed up, or computer showed up, and like how they really start thinking about, like almost offsetting the downsides of this new technology. Very interesting and very optimistic.
Yeah, I hope it makes some really cool stuff, and I hope we, you know, use it responsibly. I think we're at the tipping point societally of like AI is here, and it is going to impact our lives in some way if it hasn't already. And you know, I'm excited to see what's next.
Yeah, I think a good point that you brought up about the trust factor. I think that's probably the big problem to solve. Because as I see, like right now, is like the biggest is like, is it even correct, right? The question that they have, is it true, the information that it's kind of auto completed, so to say, by having some kind of like verification or like at least listing sources, so you can like go like one step further, and do it like checking yourself. I think this would be a huge positive addition to the technology.
Or even like a royalties system for the artists that put
this is
someone made this, and having credit for that seems like really nice.
Yeah, it's almost like the mechanism already, like the logic already exists. Just a matter of like adding this to this new tool as well, like right, the royalty mechanism. Awesome. Okay, so let's jump to career questions, which probably you keep hearing on a daily basis from your mentees and students.
Maybe.
So talking about, let's start like a bit higher, like on the job market right now? And with all the layoffs and all the, I guess, like the consequence of over flooding the job market with probably much more qualified and experienced folks, especially for somebody who comes out of new programs, either bootcamp or like full programs, or even like self-taught. So how would, like, as a potential candidate, how would you, if you were in these shoes, how would you approach job searching right now? Because it's really hard to stand out, right? Like, it's just ocean now. It's like an ocean of all the candidates. How would you really show that you can do the job and stand out?
Yeah, I think what you just said there, show the job that you can do, is like paramount. Getting a good case study is really, really significant to getting your foot into the door. That's catch 22. How can I show that I can do good work if I don't have good work? What I generally advise is to try to find a way to do that, get a client, get volunteer work. Some ways you can do this, like family friend is usually has a website or like some project they're working on. I've seen many people make the transition by like working with a friend to make a website. Some of my mentees, they actually find businesses as a part of like the design lab program on their own to just like have that client project as when they graduate. So I think those types of things help. Also the connections you make, like I'm terrible at making connections and like messaging someone randomly on LinkedIn. It's just not like, it's not my skill set. It's not what really drives me. But like going to events is a great way to meet people now that is a little bit easier to do and to try to like find stuff from there. My first UX specific title came from someone that I had met in a recruitment agency, and they helped connect me to like a job that wasn't even posted online. So that was like a really helpful connection. And then my next one was someone that I had also met in an external recruitment agency that got me into a role that was looking for someone with a very specific skill set. So those are like the ways that I would recommend. And then also if your organization, if you're like in a midsize, like a smaller organization, or even a larger one, you can pivot into design opportunities. So someone left on one of my teams after I had graduated General Assembly and I was working at Kaplan. And that person was doing a lot of like design work. And I was like, oh, can I like pick up his work in order to like build up my skill set? And my manager was like, great, I don't need to hire anyone. This is perfect. So I ended up like picking up that work and facilitating my transition even further.
Yeah, that's a very, very interesting point, especially the last one. All the previous points also valuable and valid, I agree. But the last one is also, maybe you can share a bit more opinion on this. So there is an opinion that sometimes it actually may make sense to get a job at a company that you enjoy or at least admire or want to work at as a designer, but maybe somehow like just not happening, that you cannot really get a job as a designer there. If you get a job as somebody else in this job, like kind of for a different, maybe like less demanding as a requirements profession, and then almost like, as you are saying, like asking, seeking out opportunities to almost like sneak into design team from the inside, almost like a Trojan horse of sorts. What are your thoughts on this approach? Because this is also will take some time. And not, first of all, not everybody has time. But yeah, would you consider doing this if you were just starting out?
Yeah, I mean, intent-wise, like you're agreeing to do a job that you were hired to do. So like make sure you do that job and don't sacrifice the quality of that. That being said, your foot's in the door and now you can continue to like explore once you're within that company. The concept of like starting in the mailroom, which was something that an older organization structure would promote, is like that type of theory. And I think that's fine. We had someone at Kaplan actually who's a graphic designer who wanted to like pivot into UX design, and she started doing projects for us as well with like data visualizations and other things. So yeah, once you're in the company, it becomes a lot easier to move around that company and move maybe to the part of that company you want to be in, whether that be a role or like a sector.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good call. Okay, let's talk about a bit more tactical pieces. Speaking of portfolios, resumes, any maybe do's and don'ts, red flags, like what you've seen works well from maybe like interviewer point of view, or sure. Yeah, any advice you can share here?
Yeah. So I was talking to someone about this last night, actually. I was reviewing her materials and it was like everything she was presenting was like a checklist. So it was like, here are my wireframes. Here are my, you know, user testing results. Here is my ideation. And so it's like, it was a really, you know, dry story to participate in. So all that is to say, schools teach us to do tasks. And the expectation on the student side is, oh, if I present that I did these tasks to an employer, then the employer will hire me. Unfortunately, the employer doesn't have any context into like the task that you did outside of you just presenting them that way. So you should tell them a story about why you did those things. And you hear this, like, this is probably like the most common like portfolio feedback that is given is like, tell a story with your deliverables. That's why you want to do that, because it's much more compelling to like hear a story about the ups and downs and challenges of that, rather than just be like, here's all the things in my checklist. Do I pass your qualifications or not? Yeah. Like, that's like a lot more boring. So one of the ways to stand out, tell a story in your deliverables. No one case study is the same. It kind of depends on the project and like the problem to solve and everything else that you did. The general like bones of a case study are the same. It's, you know, you had something you needed to accomplish, which is your problem to solve. You had a business you were accomplishing it for, or yourself, but you know, there's nuance there that you can talk about, but you had goals, a problem to solve, and then you like figured out how to solve it. Like, that's like your story, and that's the story every time. And that's a story you should be able to tell pretty well, with supporting visuals and narrative moments and everything else. I reference, I don't know if you're familiar with the Hero's Journey. Do you know what that is?
Yes.
Yeah. So anyone who's not familiar with it, it's actually like what Star Wars is based off of. It's a narrative device that talks about how the hero progresses through a story and goes through like trials and tribulation all the way through meeting a mentor, getting advice and making friendships and partnerships and eventually defeating the villain and coming back triumphant. That's kind of like what a case study is to me. You know, like you get these problems and then you have to figure out how to solve them through ideation, and then you come up with an amazing design idea, and you know this one design idea will do it, and you test it and validate it and present it, so implement it as well. I think that's probably the advice I would hammer home the most of like narrative in your story, not just about your materials, but about your journey as a career as well.
Fun fact about the Hero's Journey, I think it was Hero's Journey example of how I think Harry Potter movies kind of got it to the next level.
Okay.
Or maybe it was Lord of the Rings, when there's like almost like multiple loops of the same, of like within one movie, like, and then like it keeps people engaged and more engaged. It's almost like, yeah, like a roller coaster of like emotions,
yeah,
up and
exactly.
down. I agree. Yeah, I think what also maybe what I realize is challenging for folks who haven't worked in a real environment, like in a work setting yet as a designer, to really comprehend what a story really means for a case study. Because I think unless you kind of really experience and go through all the pain points or like some kind of fires that you have to deal with, or like really kind of you live through this hero journey yourself,
right.
It's probably harder to like imagine that, like especially if you're kind of coming out from the boot camp and you have, I don't know, two case studies that they gave you a template for. So it's I understand why it's hard to stand out through better storytelling, right? In this, because they just haven't went through this experience. Now, like, it's like you clearly see, like after working through dozens and dozens of different projects and products and teams, that every project is unique, like with its own set of steps in this journey, and not every single checkbox is checked, right?
Yeah.
That kind of, for example, a bootcamp would tell you like, yeah, you have to have this kind of 10 deliverables next, right? It's kind of all about templates there. And I try to kind of think about how would, like if I was running a bootcamp, how would I really solve this? And I guess, long story, but a quick answer to that I was, I think I concluded, was going back to this point about apprenticeships, right? And almost like giving this hands-on experience. And back in Vancouver when I was there, there was a very, I would say, successful bootcamp think it was called Red Academy. Some academy, I think Red Academy. Basically, they partnered with local startups and smaller businesses, and they like combined their academic curriculum with a project that was like a real life project with a real company. And I think the graduates from this particular bootcamp was they had quicker job search time frame. After they graduated, quite often they would actually continue working with those companies, like as a contractor at least to start. But there's definitely kind of having this like catch 22, right? Like having this experience to document and communicate and articulate in your case studies before, like, and then you have to get a job first of all. It's kind of definitely a tricky situation to be in.
Yeah, I think the way I think about it. And I agree with you. The apprenticeship makes a ton of sense. At General Assembly, we got like a 3-week client project, which helped. It's not the same as being embedded, but at least we're working on a real problem. I think to teach, knowing all these templates helps to like control the learning environment of the student so that they're learning optimally or at least like consistently across a cohort. I think to experience, it's much better to do one of these apprenticeships. And I think you need both. I think you need to show students how to do all these things. Then when they get into these apprenticeships, they choose what techniques they want to apply to that apprenticeship in order to solve the unique problem that they're working on. I kind of view this career as like, I'm a handyman and I have all these like different tools in like my toolkit. Yeah, and it's like, oh, okay, this, I need a screwdriver right now, or I need a wrench. Sometimes I need a hammer, you know, exactly. Like it just kind of depends.
Yeah. I like the idea of a metaphor of a toolkit. It's like really kind of a carpenter's toolkit. Like when you have very different tools for different needs, right? And sometimes they're like, you can use one tool sort of for another kind of tool job if you don't have that tool. But it's really kind of, the idea of that it's not always the same process, but the tools, you have a variety of different tools for different goals that you have or like objectives that you're trying to accomplish. And then it takes experience to know, like more to basically have more tools in your toolbox, and then know which one is the right one for the right situation, either timing or logistical constraints, even like access to your users and so on. So it's definitely comes with experience. The more tools you get into this toolbox, the more times you kind of pull it out and like do something for a particular project, the more you learn about this particular tool and when it's good. Like what kind of project is good to use it for and what kind of project not. It's always like lots of mistakes as well when you go through this learning. It's hard to I guess, fill this gap by education, like in an academic setting. But yeah, I think the best starting point would be to combine apprenticeship kind of experience, at least as a part of this curriculum program, and working with more realistic situations like for your, I don't know, graduation project or case study portfolio project.
Yeah, I think so. And your learning isn't done when you get out of school as well. Like we have to constantly learn because everything changes all the time. I mean, we just talked about AI and like that changing. So I think it takes a certain mindset as well. And just like being open to that and understanding when you go into the school, it's kind of like getting a baseline and then you have to like constantly add on top of it.
Exactly. And quite often the learnings may not align with what you learn in school, just because the real world has changed already, right? Especially with these AI tools, scary AI tools. You have to force us to relearn everything.
Yep.
But that's it seems like it's the nature of the tech industry professions, because the pace of innovation is not slowing down. It's not slowing down. Okay, going back to this kind of more tactical area. So portfolio, you mentioned that you shared your thoughts on portfolios. What about resumes? Like any tips, red flags, or best practices on what you think works as a good resume for a UX designer?
Yeah, I wonder, and maybe you have a perspective here, do hiring managers like look at resumes? I just don't know. You know, maybe recruiters do, and like that helps out a lot. I feel like LinkedIn is... the first stop now. I feel like my resume isn't as optimized, so I don't have as much like a perspective there. I do try to optimize it for like ATS, so the applicant tracking software that the resume gets fed into if I like apply to jobs a little bit more automatedly. But yeah, I actually don't have a strong perspective on resumes because I focus so much on like the portfolio and the LinkedIn presence, where you get to be a lot more like robust link skills, link like rich media, websites and past projects and all that. So yeah, I wonder how much someone looks at a resume.
Have you been involved in interviewing from like the company side?
I have, but not for finding the candidates, rather for like talking to the candidates.
Okay, so basically kind of, yeah, evaluating their skills as a designer, not evaluating the quality of their resume.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I'll look at their portfolio. That's like the first place I go. And like, I'll look at the resume, of course, and I'll be like, okay, you were like at this place for X amount of time, this place. I more often look at like the LinkedIn, which is like just a super resume to me. But
that's true. And it's, it allows you to have more information, which actually maybe not great. So it's almost like this kind of Twitter limitation, right? You have to be really crisp in your message to capture it in the limited amount of space, which I think there is a benefit of this, of the putting this on like a one or two pager resume format. I think a huge benefit, and obviously you cannot replace LinkedIn for now at least, that there is also all these integrated touch points with like where they work. So it's easier to even like see like what the company was doing. So because like in a resume, like one of the concerns that I've heard that like somebody would put like a company name, but the recruiter or a hiring manager may not have any idea about like what that company does, right? So it's like lots of candidates assume that everybody knows what that company was doing, but there's like all this kind of really static format constraints that not helping communicate or articulate what you did, why, and so on.
Yeah.
So definitely LinkedIn is, probably like the CV of the future.
Right. Our portfolio is kind of our resume too. Like design's very specific in that. Like, I don't know if engineers need like a portfolio. I don't think product managers necessarily need a portfolio. But like we do very much. So I feel like that's my resume. I will look at a resume from a design perspective, like how did you lay out the information? You know, like what sort of like spacing and typography did you use? That kind of tells me about the designer already, you know, like without the actual like content of the resume. So for design specifically, I kind of look at how the materials are presented rather than like the materials themselves as one of the ways that I think about how someone presents information, almost like a meta view of like a resume.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Portfolio is actually a better resume, I guess, does a better job in communicating what you can do as a designer, which resume should be. I think maybe like originally it was the goal of having a resume. But I think like it feels like that lots of companies still start with resume just because it's first of all like more maybe a traditional status quo kind of format of communicating some basic high-level information about the candidate. But also lots of systems are still kind of It's hard for the like applicant tracking systems that they use to kind of collect and like post jobs and all this stuff, collect resumes. It's probably they're not as smart in parsing information on like portfolio sites, right? And not every portfolio site follows like a specific standard, so which may be even more challenging for a machine to understand what it says. So that's why kind of lots of people still kind of stick with this outline of the at least companies. But then like LinkedIn would work better.
It's also homogenized. So like not everyone has a portfolio. Not everyone has work that they can share, NDA or whatever, especially like newer candidates. It's what happens in the other parts of the industry as well. Like tangential disciplines, like you can't expect like someone from sales to have a portfolio. So they need a resume. So it's like how everything else is done. I just know that when I get a resume, I go straight to the portfolio.
Where's the link to portfolio? Yes.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. I know how it feels. Okay, so maybe let's touch one more, have one more question related to, I guess, the career advice.
Yeah.
And then we'll go to the next section.
Sure.
So you talk to a lot of junior and entry-level designers who want to get in or who are trying to get in already, right? Can you maybe identify the most asked question and what advice do you give them for that?
yeah, how do I get a job?
Okay, can you be more specific?
Right, or look at my portfolio. Those are the two biggest questions. I think like my mentees are curious about different things. So I don't know if there's like a common question that they mostly have outside of those two. Those two are like probably the most like obvious ones. A lot of them actually just kind of want to see what I've done. And I think I understand the perspective here. So like when I was a student, one of my teachers at GA, she showed us some of like her work and like how she like did the job, and we just ate it up. It was so interesting to see how like we'd heard so much about how to do this stuff from learning from the templates and everything else. Like seeing actual work was like really inspiring for us. So a lot of my students actually kind of want to see what I've done. So they'll like read my articles or like they'll go to my portfolio and like look at my case studies, so that they can get a sense of like what it's going to be like when they graduate and like how to like hone their materials. I think like the underlying intent there is I want a job, but like they're also like curious about what it's like to do this type of work. So I think that's probably one of the more common questions that I get that isn't the two obvious ones. Like, can I see what you've done so that I can learn from it? So I can, I spent like a half hour last night going over like my past work with someone, one of my students, just because she was so interested in it. And I think that that's probably a lot of other students would want to see that as well.
How many mentees or students you have now, like at the time?
Recurring, I usually spend about 2 to 3 hours a week with mentorship. I have a couple of recurring ones through Design Lab. Sometimes it's like phone calls with like a family friend or something. Sometimes it's ADP lists. It kind of just depends. But yeah, probably like 3 hours. And then some people stay with me for like years. I have one person I met through ADP list that we're like, I wouldn't call him a mentor anymore. He's more like a friend.
Cool.
We met through that. Yeah, it was really nice. Yeah. I've spoken with hundreds of people. It's just like one-time conversations. Portfolio, resume, what do you think? Great. You know, and then go on from that. But
yeah, it's almost like all these mentorship kind of platform systems, like their unadvertised benefit is that you can form really strong relationships with folks instead of just kind of helping advice and like kind of what do I do next and so on. It's almost like really kind of can build friendships, right? So which is a very nice surprise.
Yeah, I mean, like came to my birthday party, like had some dinners, like it's nice. It's fun.
Really cool. Yeah. Okay. Speaking of your, I guess, number of creations, like the starting with board games and all the interactive experiences, you're also very active for like in the education in the UX, right? So you have like your own product design course. But what I'm curious more is the book and the writing and the publishing. And it looks at it like one of your recent creations is a book called with the title The Art and Science of UX Design, right? Which almost like resonates with me on just that, even the title level, because regularly, if I talk to somebody from a non-tech world and I tell them like that I'm a designer, they immediately default to the art kind of level of design. But I always think of this like as a like a combination of two, right? So it's kind of, it's both. You cannot really go with science alone and not just art, like as a graphic design. Even like then there is some science there as well. But the combination of both, almost like left side of the brain, right side of the brain, is a very interesting and like I completely agree with this. So maybe tell us a story about why you decided to write a book, because it feels like with this more, I guess the modern times, it's so easy to just create more content online by writing like Medium posts, which you have a lot as well. But what really forced you or caused you to go like the book route? Maybe share like what exactly will be the art and science of UX design from your point of view?
Yeah, definitely. So what motivated me to write the book was I've been doing a lot of writing already. And I was like, I have like a lot of content, a lot of ideas to say. I've been teaching a lot. I already had a curriculum developed. Can I turn this into a book? Maybe I can. So it turns out I could, and that was great. And I'm excited to do that. And I can't wait for it to come out. I'm very, very excited. The book is structured into 8 chapters. Like the first and last chapter are kind of like theories and concepts and whatnot. But the middle 6 chapters are the design thinking process. And it goes all the way from, you know, empathizing to defining through ideation, prototyping, testing, and implementing your solutions. And I wanted to make this experience for students to like learn those templates that we were talking about and those theories, but then also apply it to like the apprenticeship. And that's kind of what the book does. It teaches you the concepts and then it asks you to do something at the end of it. It's like exercises. And if you go through the whole thing, you end up with like a case study by the end of it, because you've gone through all of the steps of the design thinking process, kind of like doing a sprint. So I wanted to call it art and science because I agree with you. I agree this discipline is left brain, right brain. There's a lot that you have to be able to do creatively from a visual perspective with art, you know, represent designs. But then also scientifically, there's methodologies that you learn in order to apply to like ideation or like user testing or research, what have you. So I really feel like we're pulling from both disciplines. And each of those steps in the design thinking cycle also has elements of art and science in it, even if, you know, you might not think that it does. You mentioned with graphic design, there is science to that of like, you know, there is the positioning of elements and like how you think about how you space things on a screen and the colors you use influencing the result of your design. So, yeah, it also just feels like a really fun name for a title. So,
yeah, I'm really curious to take a look at the book when it's published. And when do you expect this to be available to the public?
Yeah, I'm hoping at the time of this recording, fall. We'll see how that plays out. My publishing partner, you know, controls a lot of that. So we'll see when it's all ready. But yeah.
So you went with a publishing partner again?
I did. Yeah. I published with, I approached Pearson. So I'm hoping that, you know, it's been a really great partnership and I hope that continues, for that amazing editorial team and content team and a lot of great work they've done thus far. So
that's really cool. Well, that's exciting. And you would be able to add author to your LinkedIn profile.
Exactly. Right.
Which sounds like legit and yeah, trustworthy.
Yep.
Cool stuff. Okay, last question before I let you go. If money wasn't a problem and you didn't have to worry about this, what would you do?
I would probably make games.
Really?
I'd probably go back and make some of those board games, maybe digital games. Like I would definitely travel a lot, you know. There's probably a lot that I would do.
Interesting. So I already see how the recent AI developments, AI tools developments, mm-hmm. can help address some of the value that publishing agencies can bring, like about like editors and like all this kind of more kind of these tactical things. I wonder if there is a way also like or opportunity for some other service to address the network and the reach of those agencies. So maybe you can do self-publishing then.
Yeah, maybe. I think, you know, I know a bunch of people who have done it. It's just a different like quality of life. And, you know, I want a certain quality of life. So those two things are aligned.
Yeah, more headaches for sure. Yeah. Right. More money, more headaches. That's a universal rule everywhere.
Yep.
Awesome. Okay. So considering you're very active online, where folks can find you if they have a question or want to reach out and chat more?
Yeah, definitely. LinkedIn would probably be the number one spot that I check. I do have a Twitter presence. I'm not really present on it, but it's there. Anthony.conta is usually my moniker on that. On Medium as well. So I write a lot on Medium if you'd like to check me out there. But LinkedIn's the best spot to go.
Perfect. Okay. And I'll get the links and include them in the show notes as well.
Yep.
Well, that's a wrap. This was super insightful and very interesting conversation. Lots of topics that kind of resonated with me. So I think, lots of really great points. Thank you for coming and sharing your thoughts and your advice with the audience, Anthony.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, thanks for having me. I had a blast chatting with you.